Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Welcome to the Saturday reading of the Colorado Springs Gazette. Today is Saturday, April 27th, and my name is Brent Diedrich. Today, we will be reading the top stories from around Colorado Springs, including Colorado Democrats advance two gun bills, including proposal to ban firearms in sensitive spaces. We'll look at weather, Colorado Springs weather, two rounds of rain possible Saturday, more showers Sunday. The poster child for memory, mountain chickadees can remember tens of thousands of food caches, new CU study finds. Best and brightest, brilliance in mathematics, linguistics, define student. Broncos select Utah edge rusher Jonah Ellis in third round, son of former Denver player. Avalanche vs. Jets, three takeaways from Colorado's Game 3 win, as well as many other articles from around Colorado Springs. Colorado Democrats advance two gun bills, including proposal to ban firearms in sensitive spaces, by Marianne Goodland. Colorado House Democrats on Friday gave preliminary approval to a pair of firearm bills from the state Senate, including legislation that would prohibit lawmakers from bringing guns into the Capitol. Senate Bill 131, which seeks to ban guns in sensitive spaces, initially prohibited firearms in 19 locations. The bill was amended by its sponsors to limit those locations to just a handful, including polling places, childcare, schools, public college and university campuses, and local government offices and courthouses. The bill was drafted against the backdrop of landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision on guns. In a 6-3 decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, the court in 2022 ruled that the ability to carry a pistol in public is a constitutional right guaranteed by both the 14th and 2nd Amendments. While the ruling pertains specifically to concealed weapons, it has been more broadly interpreted to apply to gun regulations nationwide. It has also led to legislative proposals prohibiting guns in sensitive places. Notably, New York, California, New Jersey, and Hawaii have all approved legislation banning firearms in sensitive places in the wake of Bruin. These new laws have largely upheld in the face of court challenges. House Republicans pointed out during Friday's debate that the state cannot bar lawmakers from bringing guns into the Capitol due to language in the state constitution, and such a policy is unenforceable. Prior to the debate, House Majority Leader Monica Duran announced time limit caps on debate of an hour each on SB 131 and on Senate Bill 3, which allows the Colorado Bureau of Investigation to conduct investigations on firearm crimes. The bill, as introduced, limited those investigations to straw purchases of firearms, when someone buys a gun for someone else who is prohibited from purchasing a firearm. As amended, the investigations can also look at ghost guns and illegal components or accessories. Significantly, SB 3 was amended to swap out a safety clause, which would allow the bill to immediately become law with the governor's signature. The amendment from Representative Gabe Evans, a Republican of Fort Lupton, changed it to a petition clause, which would allow citizens to challenge the law through the initiative process and gain the question on the November ballot. Both bills will be up for a final vote in the House on Monday, and if adopted, would go back to the Senate for review of amendments. In Colorado Springs weather, two rounds of rain possible Saturday, more showers Sunday, by Casey Dorn of KOAA. Saturday in Colorado Springs is forecast for a little bit of everything as a powerful low-pressure system moves across Colorado. We're tracking two rounds of active weather. One will continue to move throughout this morning with our snow level at around 8,000 feet. Heavy wet snow will fall in Woodland Park and Teller County as a whole, where a winter storm warning is in effect. I'm expecting 10 to 14 inches of heavy wet snow in Woodland Park, with higher totals at higher elevations. Strong upper-level low pressure is tracking through the Four Corners region this morning. As it does so, a frontal boundary is rotating north through the Front Range corridor. It will stall in the general vicinity of the Pikes Peak region, leading to rounds of showers and thunderstorms. At times, this will produce some snowflakes, particularly above 7,000 feet. But in Colorado Springs itself, the ground will remain too warm for any flakes to stick. This afternoon, patchy showers will continue in the Pikes Peak region, with steadier snow in Woodland Park and the high country. Round two will form later, leading to thunderstorm chances this afternoon. The best chance for a severe cell is on the East Plains, with a particular focus on Kiowa County. Showers will wrap up in the Pikes Peak region this evening as the boundary pushes south as a cold front, eventually leading to a drier airflow to cut off precipitation by early Sunday. Overall, this is a great drink of water for a very dry month. We'll pick up more than an inch of needed rainfall out of the storm, and likely more. Temperatures remain cold today in the 30s to 40s, strongly depending on where it's raining, snowing, and how heavily. Leftover moisture will lead to afternoon thunderstorms on Sunday. Sunday morning will be nice, with clouds increasing in the afternoon. This will be a more typical springtime thunderstorm pattern for Colorado, with scattered afternoon thunderstorms. If you plan to travel above 8,000 feet, these storms will fall with snow, meaning travel into the high country will remain tricky Sunday afternoon. Plan accordingly. We'll dry out and warm up Monday to Wednesday, with temperatures rebounding to the 70s in the Pikes Peak region under mainly sunny skies. The poster child for memory, mountain chickadees can remember tens of thousands of food caches. New CU study finds by Kelly Hayes. Although their brain is just slightly bigger than a pea, chickadees have quite the memory. A recently released study from the University of Colorado Boulder and the University of Nevada found that this little mountain bird has an incredible spatial memory, discovering nearly 100 genes associated with the chickadee's ability to recall the locations of objects. Some birds must have really good spatial memory for understanding their migratory routes, said Scott Taylor, director of CU Boulder's Mountain Research Station. Chickadees are kind of the poster child for memory in the context of hiding their food and remembering where to find it. A full-time resident in the Rocky Mountains, chickadees can remember tens of thousands of caches where they stored away seeds and other pieces of food important to surviving the Colorado winters. We know that really good spatial memory is favorable in places with really harsh winter, in high elevation sites in the mountains when the winter is long, said Georgi Semenov, the study's lead author and a research associate in the CU Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Researchers completed the study by finding multiple hanging feeders with readers that could detect a tag from wild chickadees. The research team then programmed each gate to only open to certain birds, so the chickadees had to remember the location of the feeders that would open to them. The team then measured how many times the chickadees landed on the correct feeders, with the theory that birds with better spatial memory would have a higher accuracy. As far as the genetic aspect of the study, researchers used blood samples to sequence the entire genome of 162 tagged chickadees, resulting in the largest dataset ever collected for analyzing the genetic basis of chickadee cognitive ability. From there, the team identified 97 genes associated with chickadee spatial learning and memory. We weren't even sure if we'd find the relationship between the genome and the behavior, but we did, Taylor said. With this larger data set, we've really been able to hone in on what we think are the key regions of the genome that are related to the variation that we see in chickadee spatial memory, which is pretty amazing. But that great spatial memory may come at a cost in other areas, especially in behavioral flexibility, or the ability to adjust to changes. It's not like it's always good for a chickadee to have the best spatial memory. There are other strategies that allow you to survive, which includes this behavioral flexibility, Taylor said. We haven't been able to investigate from a genetics perspective yet, so we don't have any understanding of the genetics of behavioral flexibility. But we know that in the wild, the chickadees that performed really well on the spatial cognition typically are not as behaviorally flexible, which has interesting potential implications. As climate change impacts Colorado winters, it's hard to predict exactly what that means for the chickadees with high spatial memory, both Taylor and Semenov said. We don't know what the future holds. I think the takeaway from this work is that we can use this population where selection is strong to understand the genetic basis of the trait. But the reality is we see a lot of variation within the population, Taylor said. As climate changes, organisms, they either have to adapt, they have to move, or they will die. To me, this high amount of genetic variation across the population we're studying would suggest that they will be able to adapt. Best and brightest, brilliance in mathematics, linguistics, defined student by Rachel Wright. In the summer of 2023, Lucas Anderson, a senior at the Village High School, was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder, but far from letting it cripple his life, Anderson said that in his specific case, this aspect of my life has provided benefits, foremost among them, his brilliance in both mathematics and linguistics. With both parents serving in the U.S. Air Force, Anderson spent much of his childhood moving from base to base and changed schools frequently. The move placed a great deal of strain on Anderson as he sought to build new social connections, and while he excelled in mathematics and languages, he found it difficult to engage with classes that didn't meet his educational needs. Autism, then undiagnosed, also caused significant social and sensory challenges. Anderson's diagnosis, however, served as the impetus to gain a deeper understanding and proficiency in social situations. I have striven to broaden my social sphere, diversifying the types of friendships and social relationships I have, and thereby growing my understanding of myself as a social being, Anderson said. My recent diagnosis and research have provided me with an invaluable tool for combating the difficulties it has created in my life. Anderson's drive and passion for research has propelled him through high school with a 4.3 grade point average and 18 credits beyond what is required to graduate. During his tenure at The Village, Anderson took the first space business development course, which was piloted on a Department of Defense grant by the National Space Foundation. Anderson and his fellow students advocated for a complete change in the program from a traditional junior achievement model to an innovation model where they developed, designed, and prototyped a product as well as creating a multi-year business plan to market their product. Their work was so successful that the entire program was restructured for all schools the following year, said the Village High School science teacher Carla Ray Smith. Lucas was one of the leaders of this group. It was a unique and powerful opportunity for those students that they created by advocating for a new direction. The Village High School is a hybrid model where many courses are self-paced, and Anderson has more than excelled taking so many math courses that he ran out of district options. As his mentor, I have observed how Lucas has developed his passion for the German language. He hopes to minor in German and possibly study abroad, Smith said. In addition, he is auditing ASL. Who does that? Anderson has also lent his knowledge of mathematics and engineering to outreach events for FIRST, for Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology, Robotics Challenge Team, to help raise awareness of FIRST and to encourage K-12 students to pursue a STEM education. Anderson also mentored several younger FIRST LEGO League teams, one of which reached a world-level competition. Before it became my job, Anderson said, I would volunteer to tutor students at my school. 3 days a week, Anderson would spend his lunch hour in the math peer tutoring room on call for whomever needed assistance. Anderson is tentatively planning on pursuing a bachelor's in mathematics from Oregon State University, although he is considering adjacent fields in scientific research, engineering, and computer science. Overall, my goal is to occupy myself with something that will better the state of the world, Anderson said. I wish to help solve global issues. Due to my interest in environmental protection, I have chosen to raise money for the Rainforest Alliance. This interest is also making me consider a double degree in sustainability. Avalanche versus Jets. Three takeaways from Colorado's Game 3 win. Avs host Game 4 on Sunday afternoon at Ball Arena by Kyle Fredrickson. The Avalanche defeated the Jets 6-2 Friday night in Game 3 of their first-round playoff series. Here are three takeaways from Ball Arena. Georgie, Georgie, Georgie. The Ball Arena crowd chanted early and often for their starting goaltender, Alexander Georgiev, delivered. Winnipeg scored twice in the second period, but Georgiev bounced back with a shutout third to keep the Avalanche alive for their rally. His continued rebound from an awful Game 1 performance is becoming the most important Av story this postseason. Second line production. Take a bow, Casey Mittelstadt. The second line buzzed behind their trade deadline center with the first goal of the night. Zach Parise ripping home a rebound off a Josh Manson shot attempt. Parise, a 39-year-old veteran seeking his first Stanley Cup, has two goals in his last two playoff games. Mittelstadt later assisted Arturi Lehkonen with a tape-to-tape pass on a rush goal. Special teams. The Jets led 2-1 in the second when Josh Morrissey landed a power play bomb after the Avs failed to capitalize on their own power play chance. But momentum shifted in the third period. Colorado converted two power play opportunities, goals from Nathan MacKinnon and Valeri Nishkinen, to put Winnipeg away. Winning the special teams battle was a key to the Avalanche victory. What happened? Colorado rallied from an early deficit with a strong goaltending and special teams. What went right? Zach Parise opened the scoring with the rebound goal in the first period. The Avalanche scored two power play goals in the third period. Nathan MacKinnon from the point through traffic and Valeri Nishkinen, wrister from the left circle. Ross Colton tipped in a third period goal. Devin Tejs closed the right night with an empty netter. What went wrong? Winnipeg tied the game with a Tyler Toffoli backhander at the goal line that snuck past Alexander Georgiev. The Jets led 2-1 after a Josh Morrissey power play midway through the second period. Between the pipes. Georgiev made 22 of 24 saves. Winnipeg's Connor Hellebuck stopped 34 of Colorado's 39 shots on goal. Injury report. Sam Girard, concussion protocol, returned to the lineup. Devin Tejs required stitches in the third period after taking a high stick and returned to play. What's next? The Avalanche face the Jets 12:30 p.m. Sunday at Ball Arena for Game 4 of their first-round playoff series. Broncos select Utah edge rusher Jonah Ellis in third round, son of former Denver player by Chris Thomason. There was plenty of Broncos history that surfaced Friday night. At the NFL draft in Detroit, former Broncos tight end Tony Scheffler announced that the son of former Denver player Luther Ellis has joined the team. With the number 76 pick in the second round, the Broncos selected Utah edge rusher Jonah Ellis. Luther and Jonah have become another father-son combination in team history. The Ellises follow the Grahams, with linebacker Tom Graham having played for the Broncos from 1972 to 74, and tight end Daniel Graham being with them from 2007 to 2010. Honestly, my heart dropped, Ellis said of getting the phone call from the Broncos that he had been selected. It's so exciting, I have a big smile on my face. Ellis had 12 sacks in 10 games for the Utes last season before missing the final three games due to shoulder surgery. He missed his pro day and the NFL scouting combine, but said he has been fully cleared from a medical standpoint. General manager George Patton said the Broncos are very comfortable with his medicals. Luther Ellis was a Pro Bowl Detroit defensive tackle from 1995 to 2003 before finishing his career with the Broncos in 2004 with two sacks in 8 games. He then served as team chaplain from 2015 and 16. He just told me how great of a culture, how great of a fan base, and how it was really a family vibe out there, said Jonah Ellis, said of his father's time with the Broncos. Honestly, the culture is something that he mentioned a lot and how it's really good. It's a really good bond out there. Ellis lived in Denver for a year when his father was the Broncos chaplain. It was really awesome just to see my dad start to get back into football, Ellis said. Even though he was just the chaplain at the time, you see that his love for the sport really just lights him up. The Ellises have quite the football family. Ellis has three brothers in the NFL, and Atlanta linebacker Caden Ellis, New England linebacker Christian Ellis, and Philadelphia defensive tackle Noah Ellis. Caden has played in the NFL since 2019, including spending 2019 and through 2021 with the New Orleans Saints under current Denver coach Sean Payton. Caden told me how much he loved Payton, so I'm just really excited to get out there and work for him, Ellis said. Scheffler, a Morenci, Michigan native, played in college at Western Michigan and was with the Broncos from 2006 to 2009 before finishing his career from 2010 to 2013 with the Lions. He enthusiastically announced Denver's pick while paying nod to Mike Shanahan, his former coach, and quarterback Bo Nix, taken with the number 12 pick Thursday by Denver. Put Mike Shanahan in the Hall of Fame. Let's go, Broncos. God bless Bo Nix, Scheffler, dressed in a Broncos jacket and orange tie, said before announcing Ellis's name. The Broncos are looking for Ellis to provide some additional pass rushing. They already have young edge pass rushers in Jonathan Cooper, Baron Browning, and Nick Bonito. "You're never afraid to draft on top of your strengths," Peyton said. "We'll sort that out. It's always a harder position to find in the offseason and in free agency, so we felt like he definitely checked the pressure player box." Patton said the Broncos might have traded back in the third round had Ellis not been available. Patton said that Jonah was just too good to pass. Peyton said Ellis has been on the Broncos board a half round higher than another player they were considering selecting. "We do like the versatility and growth potential of Ellis," Peyton said. "You put a blue tag on some of these guys. He had that." Ellis was the Broncos' only pick Friday. They enter Saturday's final day of the draft with six more selections. Ellis said he tries to replicate his game after New York Jets edge rusher Hassan Reddick. Ellis had a stretch last season in which he had 8 sacks in 4 games. "I really just had a burst of confidence," Ellis said. "I put in a lot of work during the offseason to get better at pass rush. I'm obviously not perfect, but that's something I put a lot of time and effort into." Ellis, who said he still must work on aspects of the run game, later missed the last 3 games with a shoulder injury he said he initially sustained early in the season. "It was unfortunate. It's something that you just have to fight through," Ellis said. Now, Ellis can't wait to report to the team for which his father once played. Police arrest at least 24 pro-Palestinian protesters at Auroria campus in Denver by Nico Brambilla and Alexander Edwards. Police officers arrested more than 24 pro-Palestinian protesters on Friday, a day after hundreds occupied a campus shared by 3 universities in Denver. Authorities also cleared several tents that went up near the Tivoli building on the Auroria campus on Thursday, when the protesters made several demands, notably that the University of Colorado divest from corporations that operate in Israel. The protest and the arrest that followed were the latest in what had been a wave of pro-Palestinian rallies on campuses across the United States in the last several days, and increasing worries by Jewish students for their physical safety. The decision to arrest the protesters followed similar scenes across several college campuses in the country. The police clashed with protesters at Ohio State University in Columbus, at the California State Polytechnic University in Humboldt. Officials closed the campus through the weekend, saying instruction would continue to be remote after protesters used furniture, tents, chains, and zip ties to block entrances to an academic and administrative building on Monday. At New York University, an encampment set up by students swelled to hundreds, and the police said 133 protesters had been taken into custody. In a statement, the Auroria Higher Education Center defended the decision to arrest the protesters by noting a campus policy that prohibits camping on the premises. Campus authorities also suggested that national disruptors had infiltrated the protest. The authorities said the protesters set up an encampment and were repeatedly notified that they did not comply with the policy. The authorities added that they tried to keep lines of communication open with the protesters. "These engagements have been aimed at attentively hearing and comprehending the students' perspectives," authorities said. The Auroria campus and the 3 higher education institutions continue to be committed to listening to and collaborating with the students and protecting their right to free speech. Notably, the authorities said some protesters falsely present themselves as representatives of the higher education institutions, adding, "We know of national disruptors who are not students who have joined this demonstration." Officers from the Denver and Auroria police departments, along with deputy sheriffs, began arresting protesters shortly after noontime. Earlier, university officials advised people to avoid the Tivoli Quad due to civil unrest. Authorities also announced road closures that shut down all inbound traffic to the campus. "Shame on you," the protesters booed, yelling at the officers to quit their jobs. At some point, the protesters locked arms and surrounded police officers who pushed and shoved as they entered and exited the crowd perimeter. One person handed out tamales to people. Moments later, the tamales were strewn over the lawn after a skirmish between the protesters and officers. All of this unfolded under the watchful eye of a drone that hovered overhead. Officers on the scene said people were arrested for unlawful assembly, but that others were handcuffed for assaulting the police. We value free speech rights and the rights to respectfully demonstrate for all students and Denverites, the Denver Police Department said in a statement, adding it played a supporting role to the Auroria Campus Police Department. After numerous requests to remove camping structures that violate campus policy, today the Auroria Campus Police Department performed arrests on some individuals who had violated that policy. Meanwhile, the tents that had been set up the night before lied in a heap on the other side of the lawn in front of the Tivoli Student Center. The protesters had begun amassing at the campus on Thursday. Among those who joined the protest yesterday was State Representative Elizabeth Epps, a Democrat who was reprimanded for joining pro-Palestinian protesters in the House gallery back in November. At the time, Epps called fellow lawmakers fascist. The reprimand from House Speaker Julie McCluskey included a sternly worded warning that such actions in the future could lead to more serious consequences. "You are our best shot at this," Epps said, referring to the protesters' goal of freeing Palestine. "It's always darkest when an empire is about to fall." State Representative Tim Hernandez, another Democrat legislator from Denver, also joined Thursday's protest. "When the sun goes down, you will not be alone," Hernandez said, noting the pro-Palestinian protests occurring in campuses elsewhere in the country. Hernandez had participated in a pro-Palestine gathering on the west steps of the state capitol a day after the deadly Hamas attacks on Israel and faced calls for reprimand from Republicans. His Democratic colleagues also called for Hernandez to explain his decision to join the October rally. Nearly a week later, Hernandez condemned Hamas for the violent attack and apologized for the harm I have caused to many in the Jewish community and the Israeli community this week. In addition to divestment, the protesters had demanded that the University of Colorado end its study abroad programs to Israel and refuse grants or funding from corporations that contract with the U.S. military. They demanded that the university write and publish a statement condemning the genocidal actions of Israel. While pro-Palestinian protests are not new, the activists in Denver set up about a dozen tents, setting up the showdown with university officials. "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," the protesters chanted. "The river is the Jordan, and the sea is the Mediterranean, between which lie Israel and the Palestinian territories." Palestinian activities say it's a call for peace and equality after 75 years of Israeli statehood and decades-long Israeli military rule over millions of Palestinians. "Jews hear a clear demand for Israel's annihilation. Chants of free Palestine echoed off the Tivoli building. A representative from Protest Legal Defense Committee used a bullhorn to provide legal advice to protesters, telling the crowd to remain silent, ask for an attorney, don't consent to a search, and ask if free to go. The representative declined a comment to the Denver Gazette. "For months and months, I've been watching children being killed with our money," Shannon Birch, a Colorado State University student. Birch said she had been there all day. Jasmine Bieland, a former CU Denver student, said she came with a first aid kit, a gallon of water, and baking soda to treat anyone who might suffer from tear gas. Similar protests have erupted elsewhere in the country. In New York, more than 100 pro-Palestinian protesters had been arrested at Columbia University, prompting the Ivy League school to cancel in-person classes and religious leaders to encourage Jewish students to celebrate Passover elsewhere. At Michigan State University, students set up an encampment on campus to pressure the university to divest in Israel amid the ongoing conflict in Gaza. Robin Huey, executive director of the Hillel Jewish Center at the university, called the encampments deeply concerning and problematic. "Students have a right to protest, but they do not have the right to intimidate or threaten Jewish students," Huey said. "Our most important priority is keeping Jewish students safe. First, foremost, and always." The university has indicated that the protesters will be required to obtain a permit from the Board of Trustees to continue their encampment. "It is my hope that the board and administration will enforce the university's own ordinances as it continues to balance safety with free speech." Several organizations said they noted a rise in anti-Semitism prior to October 7th, and that has only escalated after the Hamas attacks and Israel's response. A new study from the Anti-Defamation League and Hillel International, which surveyed American college students, said that prior to October 7th, some 76% of Jewish students felt physically safe on campus. After October 7th, that dropped to 46%. An official of Hillel of Colorado, the local chapter of Jewish student organization, in February wrote, "We've watched the change brew." Nowhere in Hillel of Colorado's mission and vision statements do the words "working to keep Jewish college students safe from harm" appear. Such a promise wasn't needed until now, wrote Shira Teed, the assistant director of the organization. "We may indeed now wonder if the past 70 years or so will go down as our golden age for the Jews in America." As the police left the campus after arresting protesters, the crowd erupted into applause. "Bye-bye," they shouted. The Associated Press contributed to this report. Dozens of deaths reveal risks of injecting sedatives into people restrained by police. An investigation led by the Associated Press has found that the practice of giving sedatives to people detained by police has spread quietly across the nation over the last 15 years, built on questionable science and backed by police-aligned experts, by Ryan J. Foley, Carla K. Johnson, and Shelby Lum. Demetrio Jackson was desperate for medical help when the paramedics arrived. The 43-year-old was surrounded by police who arrested him after responding to a trespassing call in a Wisconsin parking lot. Officers had shocked him with a taser and pinned him as he pleaded that he couldn't breathe. Now, he sat on the ground with hands cuffed behind his back and took in oxygen through a mask. Then, officers moved Jackson to his side so a medic could inject him with a potent knockout drug. "It's just going to calm you down," an officer assured Jackson. Within minutes, Jackson's heart stopped. He never regained consciousness and died 2 weeks later. Jackson's 2021 death illustrates an often hidden way fatal U.S. police encounters end, not with the firing of an officer's gun, but with the silent use of a medical syringe. The practice of giving sedatives to people detained by police has spread quietly across the nation over the last 15 years, built on questionable science and backed by police-aligned experts, an investigation led by the Associated Press has found. Based on thousands of pages of law enforcement and medical records and videos of dozens of incidents, the investigation shows how a strategy intended to reduce violence and save lives has resulted in some avoidable deaths. At least 94 people died after they were given sedatives and restrained by police from 2012 through 2021, according to findings by the AP in collaboration with Frontline and the Howard Centers for Investigative Journalism. That's nearly 10% of the more than 1,000 deaths identified during the investigation of people subdued by police in ways that are not supposed to be fatal. About half of the 94 who died were Black, including Jackson. Behind the racial disparity is a disputed medical condition called excited delirium, which fueled the rise of sedation outside hospitals. Critics say its purported symptoms, including superhuman strength and high pain tolerance, play into racial stereotypes about Black people and lead to biased decisions about who needs sedation. The use of sedatives in half these incidents has never been reported, as scrutiny typically focus on actions of the police, not medics. Elijah McCain's 2019 death in Aurora, Colorado was a rare exception. Two paramedics were convicted of giving McClain an overdose of ketamine, the same drug given to Jackson. One was sentenced last month to 5 years in prison. The other was sentenced Friday to 14 months in jail and probation. It was impossible to determine the role sedatives may have played in each of the 94 deaths, which often involved the use of other potentially dangerous force on people who had taken drugs or consumed alcohol. Medical experts told the AP their impact could be negligible in people who were already dying. The final straw that triggered heart or breathing failure in the medically distressed or the main cause of death when given in the wrong circumstances or mishandled. While sedatives were mentioned as a cause or contributing factor in a dozen official death rulings, authorities often didn't even investigate whether injections were appropriate. Medical officials have traditionally viewed them as mostly benign treatments. Now, some say they may be playing a bigger role than previously understood and deserve more scrutiny. Time and time again, the AP found agitated people who were held by police face down often handcuffed and with officers pushing on their backs, struggled to breathe and tried to get free. Citing combativeness, paramedics administered sedatives, further slowing their breathing. Cardiac and respiratory arrest often occurred within minutes. Paramedics drugged some people who were not a threat to themselves or others, violating treatment guidelines. Medics often didn't know whether other drugs or alcohol were in people's systems, though some combinations caused serious side effects. Police officers sometimes improperly encouraged paramedics to give shots to suspects they were detaining. Responders occasionally joked about the medication's power to knock their subjects out. Night Night is heard on videos before deaths in California, Tennessee, and Florida. Emergency medical workers, if they aren't careful, can simply become an extension of the police's handcuffs, of their weapons, of their nightsticks, said Claire Zikorsky, a former paramedic and an addiction researcher at the University of Texas at Austin. Supporters say sedatives enable rapid treatment for drug-related behavioral emergencies and psychotic episodes. Frontline responders from violence are safely administered thousands of times annually to get people with life-threatening conditions to hospitals. Critics say forced sedation should be strictly limited or banned, arguing the medications, given without consent, are too risky to be administered during police encounters. Ohio State University professor Mark DeBard was an important early proponent of sedation, believing it could be used in rare cases when officers encountered extremely agitated people who needed rapid medical treatment. Today, he said he's frustrated officers will still sometimes use excessive force instead of treating those incidents as medical emergencies. He's also surprised paramedics have been given unnecessary injections by overdiagnosing excited delirium. Others say the premise was flawed, with sedatives and police restraint creating a dangerous mix. The deaths have left a trail of grieving relatives from coast to coast. They're running around in the streets administering those heavy-duty medications that could be lethal, said Honey Gutsalenko, a nurse whose husband died after he was injected with midazolam in 2021 while restrained by police near San Francisco. It's just not right. I'm begging you to stop. Jackson was standing on a truck outside a radio station on the border of the small Wisconsin cities of Eau Claire and Altoona. An employee called 911 before dawn on October 8, 2021, hoping officers could shoo away a stranger who doesn't seem to be a threat, but not normal either. Police video and hundreds of pages of law enforcement and medical records show how the incident escalated. An Altoona police officer met Jackson in the parking lot. Jackson appeared uneasy and paranoid, looking around and talking softly. He had taken methamphetamine, which a psychiatrist said used to self-medicate for schizophrenia. He'd been in and out of jail and living on the streets with frequent visits to the emergency room seeking a place to rest. The officer, joined by a second Altoona officer and a sheriff's deputy, told him he could leave if he gave his name. Jackson refused. Police identified him through his tattoos, learning he was on probation for meth possession. They noticed the truck had minor damage and decided to arrest him. Jackson took off running. The officers chased Jackson, who stopped seconds later and staggered toward the first officer. Body cam video shows she fired her taser, its dart striking Jackson in the stomach and thigh. He screamed after the electrical shock and collapsed. When officers couldn't handcuff Jackson, she fired additional darts striking Jackson in the back as he lay on the ground. Officers from the Eau Claire Police Department forced Jackson onto his stomach to be handcuffed and restrained him in what's known as the prone position. I'm begging you to stop, Jackson said. I can't breathe. After a couple of minutes, officers moved him to his side and sat him up, trying to improve his breathing. An officer wondered out loud whether Jackson had excited delirium and asked a colleague if paramedics were going to stand around and do nothing. He voiced approval when one officer with ketamine, adding Jackson would not like it when he gets poked. The Eau Claire Fire Department's excited delirium protocol advises rapid sedation is the key to de-escalation. The medic measured 400 milligrams after estimating the 6-foot-tall Jackson weighed 175 pounds, enough to immobilize someone within minutes. He injected the medicine into Jackson's buttocks. Five medical experts who reviewed the case for AP said Jackson's behavior did not appear to be dangerous enough to justify the intervention. I don't believe he was a candidate for ketamine, said Connecticut paramedic Peter Canning, who said he supports sedating truly violent patients because they stopped fighting and are sleeping by the time they get to the hospital. Minutes later, Jackson stopped breathing on his way to Sacred Heart Hospital. He'd suffered cardiac arrest and, after he was resuscitated, had no brain function. Jackson's mother, Rita Gallons, collapsed while shopping at an Indiana Walmart when she learned her oldest son was hospitalized and not expected to survive. Gallons rushed to the hospital 500 miles away, where she was told he'd been injected with ketamine. She searched online and was stunned to read it's used to tranquilize horses. Gallons spoke to Jackson, held his hand, and hoped for a miracle. She eventually agreed to remove him from a ventilator after his condition didn't improve, singing into his ear as he took his final breath. You've never lost a battle, and I know, you never will. She still has nightmares about how police and medics treated her son, whom she recalls as a happy boy with chunky cheeks that she inspired, giving him the nickname Meatball. There are a few days when she doesn't ask, why did they give him an animal tranquilizer? Ketamine moves to the streets. The practice of using ketamine to subdue people outside hospitals began in 2004 when a disturbed man scaled a fence, cut himself with a broken bottle, and paced along a narrow strip of concrete on a Minneapolis highway bridge. The man was in danger of falling in the traffic below when officers reached through the fence and grabbed him. Dr. John Hick, who worked with first responders, heard the emergency radio chatter while driving and rushed to the scene with an idea. Hick gave the man two shots of ketamine, started an IV, and kept him breathing with an air mask. The man stopped struggling, and responders lowered him to safety. Paramedics had, occasionally, used other sedatives to calm combative people since the 1980s. Hick and his Hennepin County Medical Center colleague, Dr. Jeffrey Ho, believed ketamine worked faster and had fewer side effects, showing promises to avert fatal police encounters. Ho was a leading researcher on taser safety and an expert witness for the company in wrongful death lawsuits. In a 2007 deposition in one such case, he argued for a potentially life-saving tactic of having sedative injections quickly follow taser shocks, saying the combination could shorten struggles that, if prolonged, might end in death. Some doctors at his public hospital in Minneapolis were using something called ketamine, which is an analog to LSD, he said. It's sort of an animal tranquilizer. The drug became more common outside the hospital in 2008 when Hennepin County paramedics were given permission to use it. An American College of Emergency Physicians panel that included Ho said in 2009 that ketamine had shown excellent results and safety while acknowledging no research proved it would save lives. Its use became standard from Las Vegas to Columbus, Ohio, to Palm Beach County, Florida. The earliest death involving ketamine documented in AP's investigation came in 2015, when 34-year-old Juan Carrizales was injected after struggling with police in the Dallas suburb of Garland, Texas. Shortly after ketamine became authorized for such use in Arizona in 2017, deputies who were restraining David Cutler face down in handcuffs in the scorching desert asked the paramedic to sedate him. The medic testified he was surprised when Cutler stopped breathing, although the dose was larger than recommended for someone weighing 132 pounds. He said he had been trained that ketamine didn't impact respiration. Cutler's death was ruled an accident due to heat exposure and LSD, though that was disputed by experts hired by Cutler's family, who said heat stroke along with ketamine caused his death. In Minneapolis, an oversight agency found the use of ketamine during police calls rose dramatically from 2012 through 2017, and body camera video showed instances of officers appearing to pressure paramedics to use ketamine and joking about its power. The department told officers they could never suggest or demand the use of sedation. Facing criticism, Hennepin Healthcare halted a study examining the effectiveness of ketamine on agitated patients. The Food and Drug Administration later found the research failed to protect vulnerable, intoxicated people who had not given consent. By 2021, the American College of Emergency Physicians warned ketamine impacted breathing and the heart more than previously believed. Ketamine is not as benign as we might have hoped it to be, a co-author of the new position, Dr. Jeffrey Goodlow, said on the group's podcast in 2022. He said the practice of giving large doses of ketamine, sometimes too much for smaller patients, had spread nationwide as agencies copied each other's protocol with little independent review. but the AP's findings show risks of sedation go beyond ketamine, which was used in at least 19 cases. Roughly half of the 94 deaths documented by the AP came after the use of midazolam, which has long been known to heighten the risk of respiratory depression. Many came during police encounters in California, where ketamine is not widely used. Midazolam, a common pre-surgery drug known by the brand name Versed, is also part of a three-drug cocktail used in some states to execute prisoners. Other cases involved a range of other drugs, including the antipsychotic medications haloperidol and ziprasidone, which can cause irregular heartbeats. The need for monitoring side effects is often laid out for paramedics in written guidelines, many of which are based on the disputed belief that excited delirium can cause sudden death. The history of excited delirium, the theory of excited delirium, was troubling from the start. In 1980s, with cocaine use soaring, Dr. Charles Whetley, a Miami forensic pathologist, coined the term to explain a handful of deaths of violent cocaine use, many of which had been restrained by police. Whetley, who died in 2020, also blamed excited delirium for the mysterious deaths of more than a dozen black women. He said cocaine and sexual activity triggered the fatal condition. The women's deaths eventually were attributed to a serial killer. Whetley's theory survived. And over time, symptoms described by Whetley and others, superhuman strength, animal-like noises, and high pain tolerance, became disproportionately assigned to black people. The term spread to police and emergency medical services to describe certain agitated people and explain sudden deaths. By the mid-2000s, police were encountering more drug users and mentally ill people as stimulant use increased and psychiatric hospitals closed. Departments adopted tasers as a less lethal alternative to firearms, but there was a problem. Hundreds died after being jolted. Supporters of Whetley's research, including the medical examiner in Miami-Dade County, ruled again and again that excited delirium was the cause of these deaths, not the effects of the weapons and others' physical force. Executives at Taser's manufacturer agreed, promoting excited delirium to medical examiners around the country and retaining experts who explain the concept to juries in wrongful death lawsuits. In 2006, a grand jury that investigated taser-related deaths in Miami-Dade recommended an untested treatment that it said could save people before they died from excited delirium, squirting midazolam up their noses to cause almost immediate sedation. Its report acknowledged they may experience difficulty in breathing. Miami-Dade paramedics adopted this treatment. But key medical groups didn't recognize excited delirium, and activists were calling for limits on taser use. What happened next would help promote sedation alongside tasers as tools to gain control. In 2008, the biggest names in excited delirium research gathered at a Las Vegas hotel for a three-day meeting organized by a group with ties to taser's manufacturer. A lot of talk took place on chemical sedation because the cops didn't know what to do with these people, recalled John Peters, president of the Institute of the Prevention of In-Custody Deaths, which sponsored the meeting. Jeff Ho had done some work up in Minnesota. He said, look, I've been using ketamine. It knocks them out quicker. The timing was fortuitous. The American College of Emergency Physicians would soon form a task force to study excited delirium and how police and medics should respond. The 19-member panel included Ho, who became Taser's medical director under an arrangement in which the company paid part of his hospital salary. Dr. Donald Dawes, a Taser research consultant, and University of Miami researcher Deborah Mash, who testified for Taser about several deaths she blamed on excited delirium. At least two other panelists were routinely retained by officers and their departments as expert witnesses. The panel's 2009 paper disclosed none of these relationships. It found excited delirium was real, could result in death regardless of whether someone was shocked with a taser, and called for aggressive chemical sedation to treat the symptoms. DeBard, the now-retired Ohio doctor who chaired the panel, told AP he recruited relevant experts to join and that disclosure of conflicts wasn't required by the ER doctors group then. He said Taylor didn't influence the outcome, which reflected the panel's consensus. Mash said she had no conflict because Taser didn't fund her research. Dawes declined an interview request. Ho didn't return messages. Taser rebranded itself in 2017 as Axon. A spokesperson for the company declined interview requests and did not respond to written questions. Dr. Brooks Walsh, an emergency physician in Connecticut who was not on the panel, said the 2009 paper reinforced racial bias as it formalized loaded terms used to describe excited delirium, influencing how the diagnosis would be applied. Ho and other Taser and police-aligned experts joined a federally sponsored panel in 2011 that built on the work, recommending four actions on a checklist for officers and paramedics. Identify excited delirium symptoms, control with a Taser if necessary, sedate, and transport to a hospital. No test measures for excited delirium, so paramedics faced a judgment call. Which patients were so agitated, strong, and impervious to pain and dangerous they needed to be sedated? DeBard said the symptoms were based on medical observation, not race. If you've got somebody that's delirious, irrational, aggressive, hyperactive, running around naked, I mean, it's really pretty easy to recognize, he said. Yet, over time, prominent medical groups and some experts pointed to overuse of sedation during police encounters in a disproportionate amount impact on Black people. Even supporters of the practice have acknowledged that the wrong patients at the wrong times have been injected. Convenient for law enforcement. In more than a dozen cases reviewed by AP, police asked for a suggested use of sedatives, calling into question whether medics were working for law enforcement or in patients' interest. Officers suggested their detainees had excited delirium. We need to be more sure that folks are treated in a way that their medical needs and not simply given a chemical restraint because it's convenient for law enforcement, said University of California, Berkeley Law and Bioethics Professor Osaji Obasoji. Paramedics say they make medical decisions independently from police following guidelines that call for sedating people who may be dangerous. But in several cases, AP found people were injecting, though they had calmed down or even passed out after struggles with police. Ivan Gutzelenko, a 47-year-old father who was struggling to breathe as two officers restrained him in Richmond, California. Gutzelenko said told the officers they were hurting him and bucked to try to get one off his back. A paramedic viewed Gutzelenko's action as aggression and went to his ambulance to get a 5-milligram dose of midazolam. When he returned 3 minutes later, Gutzelenko lay motionless. He's faking like he's unconscious, an officer said. The medic plunged the needle into his bicep. Gutzelenko's heart stopped. He was declared dead at a hospital. A pathologist testified that midazolam was given to quiet him down during an episode of excited delirium, but did not contribute to the death, which he blamed on prone restraint and meth use. His wife said Gutzelenko, a former critical care nurse, would have never consented to receive midazolam that day. The AP investigation found half who died following sedation had been shocked with the taser and the majority had been restrained face down. Lawmakers in Colorado banned excited delirium as a justification for using ketamine and put other restrictions on the drug, but changes in the law elsewhere have been few. Paramedic reformers are working to address the failures that increase the risk of sedatives contributing to deaths. Paramedic Eric Jaeger helped rewrite New Hampshire's protocols and, at a fire station in Hooksett, recently used Jackson's death as a training scenario after evaluating the case for AP. He questioned whether sedation was necessary. He said medics failed to thoroughly evaluate Jackson and should have had monitoring equipment ready before any injection. He said he had been aware of a handful of deaths, but the number found by AP dramatically increases the scope. If we don't change the training, change the protocols, change the leadership to make the system safer, Jaeger said, then we all bear responsibility for future deaths. Thank you for listening to the Saturday reading of the Colorado Springs Gazette. Today is April 27th, Saturday, and my name is Brent Diedrich.
AfterSight presents your low vision resource of the day. Today we would like to highlight one of our favorite recreational services, Foresight Ski Guides. This organization aims to make snow sports both affordable and accessible to low vision and blind skiers. Learn more by visiting www.foresightskiguides.org. That's foresightskiguides.org. Or calling 303-506-3859 or emailing foresightskiguides@gmail.com.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777. You're listening to Aftersight.